Welcome to Opera San Jose's Opera Talks. This is a podcast recording session, September 9th, 2016 at 2 p.m. in the General Director's office. And we have with us today Sylvia Lee, who is singing Lucia. And we have Colin Ramsey, who's singing Raimondo.
Hi.
The things that are interesting to me as the General Director is that these are two singers who have arrived at for the first time in San Jose.
Yeah.
Yes.
And their first time in this company. And their first time in a residency, probably anywhere, right? You've never been a member of a resident company?
No, not like a resident company like this.
Yeah. So it's a whole new world for them, and they've just arrived. And they've been rehearsing one opera, and they're about tomorrow night. They're going to open up with Lucia de Lammermoor, and Sylvia is singing Lucia, and Colin Raimondo, as I mentioned. And I'd like to know more about you guys. So, Sylvia,
yes.
Having come from the farthest place away,
yes.
Sylvia comes all the way from Korea,
yes.
And I know you've sung in Asia a bit.
Yes.
Where did you sing over there?
I sang in Korea, South Korea, Seoul, with Korea National Opera, which is the biggest opera
company. Very good
in Korea.
Yeah.
And then one in Hong Kong with Opera Viva. Musica Viva.
Right, yeah.
And yeah.
So, and you also, I know you worked for a time, or you lived for a time in London and were studying there.
Yes.
Did you do any singing in England?
I did several concerts, and also I sang in Amsterdam often.
Nice.
Yeah,
not bad.
I had really good concerts there, yeah. Singing and Queen of the Night aria.
All right. And I know
for
you were
Christina Dutokum.
All right.
Wow. Yes. It was the concert celebrating her 80th birthday. So
that's an honor.
Yeah, it was really honored to sing in front of her. She's famous.
Yeah.
She's Queen of the
Night.
Yeah. Queen of the Nights, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That would scare me.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
I was scared, and then my teacher told me, you know, if you don't sing well, that's also good because it honors her more.
It shows how good she is.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I know that when mezzos were having to sing roles that Irene performed.
Oh, God. I can't even imagine what
It made them very nervous.
Of course.
And the ones who adjusted best are the ones who came to her office to say, do you have any pointers about this role?
Yeah.
And then she would sit with them and coach them right through. She would come to my house on Saturday, and they would work through the whole opera together. And do this, and this is what I did, and other singers have done it this way.
Yeah.
But this is the most important moment in the evening. This is when you lay your cards on the table as in this character.
Right.
And walk them through it. Oh, by the way, honey, you need to save yourself on these two pages because these two pages are going to eat it up. So save yourself here. Don't. It's okay. Mm-hmm. And then deliver over here.
Yeah, it's incredibly useful to be able to talk to people who have done roles many, many times,
yes.
Even if you don't particularly like their interpretation or anything, because anytime someone has just done an opera a bunch of times, they're going to know all of those things, like
you
where to give,
so
where to relax, what the audience is going to go for, what they're not going to go for.
Yeah, you could work your tail off on this and the audience will never care.
Like you might think, this is this is so hard. This is everyone's going to think this is the greatest moment in the opera, and they're all kind of like, what? Huh? I don't get it. It wasn't interesting at all. So, it's a really valuable thing.
And then you worked at Virginia Opera.
Yes,
that's a company I've known for forever.
Yes, I sang Gilda in Rigoletto.
Perfect
and
for you.
That was just wonderful experience.
Yeah,
for me.
Perfect role for you.
I love singing Gilda, Lucia, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, they're pretty perfect roles.
Yes.
So, Colin. I know when I was talking to you, you were living in Southern California.
Yes.
Is that home base?
Right. Yes. That's been home base for a while. I mean, I was born in New York City and I grew up in Connecticut, but, in 2007, when I graduated high school, my, parents moved to Orange County. And so all of my home moved there. And so when I, was going home for the holidays, it was always to Southern California. And so I've been there since 2007, and I went to college in New York City, and then when I graduated, I was done with the hustle and bustle of that town, and just was like, you know what, I'm going to go to the beach for a couple of years and see how that treats me. And it was great, because there's a lot of opera in California, and I got to sing with a lot of smaller companies in the state.
You've done a lot of singing. When I look at your biography, I just see myriad companies. Traveling a lot, clearly.
Yeah. Well, it's been, I mean, it's been great and it's been tiring and all of, I mean, and wonderful and all of that stuff all at the same time. I mean, Sylvia, you obviously get it too, because, I mean, you just came here from London, which is quite the schlep. But
oh, that was a night of adventure. Yeah. We couldn't find each other in the airport.
Yeah.
We couldn't find each other in the airport. We were on different floors.
Yeah. It's always
new airports are tough, but that's even one of the like little details of the travel. But it's been fun because I'm still very young, and when I started doing a lot of these gigs, and when I finished school, I kind of just thought, well, I'll go and audition and see what happens, and if people want to hire me, and what that'll be like. And so I just went out and I got a job in Utah and a job in Seattle and a job in Florida, and just kind of things sort of one thing led to the next. And I, since I was young, I mean, I still am young, but being young and single, I was kind of just like, great, I'll just go. I've got I can leave my stuff with my parents and I'll just go and do opera jobs. And so that was wonderful, because I know me personally, I never learned well in a classroom. Like, that was, school was good for what it was, but I learned the most, being on stage, making mistakes, being in rehearsal and doing something idiotic and having my director be like, Colin, face out, mm-hmm. Don't sing to the wings, what are you doing, Colin? That was so much better than being in a classroom and having a teacher tell me, now, make sure that when you're walking, you're at this angle so your face is facing out and your legs are going this way. And I was like, I don't get it. Can we just do it? And so I fell down a couple times, which was great, because I mean, that's the time to do it. But I loved getting out and meeting new people in different cities and singers. And, one of the coolest experiences for me was I got to do this Don Carlo in Austin. And nobody does Don Carlo, that opera. And it's one of my favorite pieces. And King Philip is, of course, one of the roles that I'd love to do someday. And to just be in that opera and get to sing the small role with the aria at the beginning, and then I come back at the end. It was it was perfect. Little things like that along the way have been so formative. And then also to get to go to cities like Austin and Seattle and Miami, and just to be there. I mean, Seattle is one of my favorite cities.
Oh, I love
it. It's so cool.
I haven't been there yet.
Oh, Seattle's great. And you know what's even more fun, at least was for me? Vancouver.
I've heard great things about Vancouver.
I love Vancouver.
Okay.
There was an Opera America conference there.
Yeah.
So we were there for a solid week, right? And I had to go early because I was a new general director and they had special things for the new general director. So I had to be there sometime early.
Yeah.
So I was there quite a while and I thought, I don't want to leave. And they said, oh, wait, you don't understand. This is the longest stretch of sunshine we have had in 40 years. when we arrived, everybody was given an umbrella, right? And I thought, why?
This is so beautiful. No, that's the thing up there. It's when it's beautiful, it's just incredible. That whole part of the world.
In London, too.
Like when the sun comes out and it gets so green, that's the other thing. Everything is this incredible green everywhere. And the water and... Very cool.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's one of the big perks of, I guess, being a singer is making all that, those travels.
Well, while we're on this idea of you being young.
Yeah.
You're a young bass. You're not just young.
Yes. I've been a young bass my whole life.
that's a rare, not your whole life.
Well, most of it.
Well, since you were 14. But there's a combination here, because the world expects a bass to be old.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and the characters and that are often written are
Simone Boccanegra, Philip. You almost Sarastro.
Yeah,
when you start thinking of the bass roles, they're almost always old guys,
with some exceptions. I mean,
even Raimondo.
Raimondo is often portrayed as a much older man, and it's definitely been it's a challenge, and also, I mean, there's of course also the vocal maturity part of it, which is a whole. There's two conversations to be had with this, and the look is it's gravitas is the word I always think of, because it's not just about makeup can do wonders. I mean, really, we can do so many great things with makeup, and I tend to look pretty young, but you know, if someone, I get a good, you know, person in the makeup room, then I can look much older. But it's the ability to present yourself in the way and carry yourself in the way that an older person would. And for me, I'm, you know, like, I have so much energy, and I'm like always, you know, I have too much energy, especially on stage when I get excited. The hardest thing for me to learn was how to just stand still and just stay there and think, okay, I'm a 60-year-old man who has no need to take extra steps, and everybody in this room thinks I'm very important, and mm-hmm. I know that I'm very important, and so I don't have anywhere to go. Like, I'm just going to sit here and take it. Like, Zarathustra was so, it was so fun for that reason, but also incredibly challenging because there's this importance of the way you carry yourself, and like when you walk onto the stage and the whole chorus looks at you like, this is the guy, you know. I mean, the flute, you know, in flute, everyone's like, the queen of the night, the queen of the night, the queen of the night. And then you appear and you've got to deliver once you appear. And Zarathustra, everyone's talking about Zarathustra, Zarathustra, Zarathustra. And then you walk out and you just sing that opening line. It's so beautiful, but it's so terrifying at the same time because you know the audience and is expecting Zarathustra. And being a young guy, it's like, I'm not used to being that guy.
Yeah, they would expect you as Papageno.
Yeah, yeah. They look at, you know, people look at me like, oh, Figaro, Papageno, blah, blah, blah. But these older guys that have that kind of presence it's a different thing. And even just the struggle of auditioning and walking in and someone saying, okay, we need to cast Timur in like Turandot.
Oh.
And, you know, he's a super, super old guy almost always, but it's not a very big role and one that easily could be sung by a younger guy. And they'll take one look at me and just say, no. I mean, you would take one look at me and be like, not a team.
Wait a minute. I took one look at you and hired you.
You did. So thank you for that.
And I know that Raimondo is supposed to be an old guy, right? But I don't care. And we came up with a whole different idea of who Raimondo is.
And the nice thing about him in particular is that there's nothing in the in the opera that
nobody says he's old.
Age. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody says, what, the old guy?
Yeah.
You're a chaplain. You could be there's nothing to do with age.
20, 30.
Yeah, it really could be anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I always think of, too, when going back to Don Carlo and, like, old guys, historically, at the time of these events, Philip was really in his, like, early mid-30s, actually, at the time of the events of Don Carlo. You know, he talks about his white hair and blah, 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 all this stuff. But
that's made up.
That's more of Verdi's characterization of him, that he's this old man. But Philip at that time was actually, Carlo was very young. And Philip was, I mean, today he would be considered a fairly young man, like in the prime of his life, which totally changes the context of that story.
Well, since you can't get a young-looking person who can sing Carlo.
Try to get a 15-year-old that can sing Carlo.
So the age for both of them has to go
up.
Yeah.
That's right.
But no, it's being a young bass is a challenge, and everyone is always saying, oh, well, you know, you'll come into your voice in your 40s, in your 50s. I mean, I had one person who said, well, you should just go do something else until you're 45, and then when you're 45, restart your career, because that's when you'll come into your voice.
But that's...
And I just looked at her, and I was like, you are out of... What am I going to... How will I possibly become a great artist by stopping for 20 years?
Just mentions when Cesare Siepi first performed Philip at the Metropolitan Opera.
Yeah, he was 27.
He was your age, exactly.
Yeah. He was my age. And my little point of pride for myself is that Siepi made his operatic debut in Rigoletto as Sparafucile when he was 19 years old, and I did the same thing.
Ha!
So, you know, it's age, I mean... Yes, it's important to developing in your voice. And I mean, gosh, like thinking about where my voice was when I was 20 versus where it is now, it's grown so much. And I love that whole process. But at the end of the day, sometimes I'm like, I can do it, you know? Like, it's good to be young for some of these things. Mm-hmm. Mephistopheles, the Boito is one of those roles where I think it's much better to be done as a young man because you need to have so much more energy and be able to move around the stage and... in a very different way than you would for Fiesco or Philip or any of these older guys. But yeah, it's young bass. It's a very long and difficult path, I think. And a lot of people get cut out early. And even problems like the color of my voice. I mean, I remember going to MSM and my first teacher there saying, well, this can't possibly be your voice.
Oh.
You must be a baritone. you must be doing something strange. And I thought, I don't feel like I'm doing anything weird. This is just my, I've had a low voice since I was in fifth grade. Like, this is nothing new. And she's like, no, okay, you know, you're still too young. And that to this day will happen to me. And so it's an odd thing that people have conceptions about, but you just kind of have to...
You just have to be true to the instrument. You don't have a choice.
No, you stick to your guns.
Yeah, a cello is a cello is a cello. It can't be a violin, and vice versa.
Exactly.
And how sad it is when we have singers come in who believe they are violins, but they're really violas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And that's really hard on them because they don't know which direction to go, and they keep trying to push themselves into another place, and then... Of course, I've been 33 years here, so I've seen singers move on into careers, right? Mm-hmm. And I've seen them just be destroyed within 5 years of having left Opera San Jose because they went in a direction that clearly was not correct, mm-hmm. but companies would hire them because they could phony it up, right?
Yeah.
Create a sound that's not natural to the instrument, and 5 years later, they're not singing at all. They're working in a music store somewhere.
Yeah,
because they've just wrecked the instrument altogether.
It's
by
a
going
brutal,
out to
brutal
sing
business.
Wagner and Freischütz and all these things when they really weren't ready for that.
Yeah,
Sylvia, on the other hand,
yes,
I think you are exactly your body and your voice.
She's perfect,
and your personality all mesh into one thing.
Well, my personality is different because
once
my teacher told me that I'm a coloratura with spirito basso profondo.
I love that phrase.
With the spirit of a basso profondo.
Yes.
Well, okay, I'll go for that a little bit. Because I've now been watching you in Lucia rehearsals for a while.
Yes.
And I've certainly been enjoying watching you as Lucia.
That's so nice
and hearing you as Lucia.
Thank you.
And I send you little texts that tells you that.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's my favorite mode of communication now in the theater. I've discovered that I can put the singer's phone numbers into my phone and I can text them during the performance.
Yeah.
So when they have just sung the Regnava nel Silenzio, little Cassinia, your cover, the other day in her first technical run with the orchestra, she's just sang it, right? I mean, she went out there and she sang it. And I know it was something she'd been struggling with. And she walked out there and she nailed it. And I just, she's still on stage and I'm sending her a text with how excited I was for her that she went out there and just nailed all the coloratura. It was a smack in place and exciting.
Yeah.
And I was so happy for her. And I'm so happy for you.
Oh.
You're going to have a debut here that the public is going to love.
Oh, they're going to go nuts.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they already went nuts. The kids went crazy after the mad scene.
Yes.
They went crazy after a bunch of things, but they love the mad scene.
Yeah, everybody loves
the mad scene.
I mean,
But you sing it so well. That helps. That definitely helps.
Thank you.
And that's something I did ask people, what would you like to find out? And one of the questions for you that was sent in was, what do you do to prepare yourself physically and emotionally, and then the woman was saying, and psychologically yourself, to be able to face that, what is it, 18 minutes of solo singing? What do you do?
So I try to pacing myself very well. I mean, I have to calculate when I sing out or when I sing less so I can save my voice until the end.
Yeah, because you have a really high note at the end.
Yes, and a couple of high notes.
You have a lot.
2D, high D, and 3 E flat, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one small D, C sharp or C.
But he's constantly sending you. You're the highest voice at the end of the biggest ensemble with everything going tutti, right? All the chorus, all the soloists, and the whole orchestra. And you get stuck.
So I have to really calculate every moment where to rest my voice and where to sing out.
So actually, it's not a psychological thing for you. It's an intellectual thing for you.
Yes.
You sit down and figure out where in this score I can do this and I can do that.
Yes.
Donizetti was very kind.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time when you're singing, it's strings and pizzicato.
Yes.
Oh, it's very... The orchestration is quite good.
I mean,
There are moments... I mean, this is a tricky piece because there are a few moments where the orchestra just... It just surprises you.
Mm-hmm. They just wail.
It's just huge.
They just wail.
And it's so exciting. I mean, that's one of the things I think that's so great about the opera is you're going along and it's, this lovely, beautiful bel canto thing, and then all of a sudden it's Otello for you know, a page, like, and then it drops step, right back down. Yeah, which is really fun, but it does mean we're all kind of like keeping an eye on that.
Yes.
Pacing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are so many things I can do because orchestration is so light. I can do this and that. Like, I can mm-hmm. do diminuendo, crescendo, mezza di voce, and portamento, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
The things that color the emotion. Because after all, the bel canto era is about beautiful singing by its title.
Yeah.
But it is not just about beautiful singing. It's about beautiful singing at the service of high emotion.
Yes,
exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
And the emotions that are both loud and the emotions that are crushed under the weight of the world, and you can barely utter the sound. Mm-hmm. It's got both of those extremes.
Yeah.
It tends to work in extremes.
Yes.
And those high points are what we all wait for, right? Everybody's waiting for the cabaletta. Okay, go ahead and sing Rinnovas nel Silenzio, but now give me the cabaletta. You know, we're all waiting for those. Yes. Really, what are the fireworks? That's what drives audiences to happiness.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the drama is a whole different animal. You're probably aware that when Sir Walter Scott wrote this thing, he was very, very ill.
Oh.
And he was in bed and on drugs, opiates.
Oh, I did not know that.
He was very ill. And he dictated the whole thing. So he spoke Lucia Lammermoor, the Bride of Lammermoor. He spoke it, and it was written down for him. And it was published, supposedly, before he had actually made his recovery. And he read it and went, I disavow this work. I was drugged out of my mind.
It is a crazy story in some ways.
Yes. And it sold out in 2 weeks.
Wow.
The whole publication sold out in 2 weeks.
Amazing.
And so then he had to come out with a second printing, but he decided to make a new edition.
Oh.
Yeah.
So he changed the period and everything, changed a lot of stuff, and it brought the period from the 17th century to the 18th century.
Right.
He just messed with it, which has led, perhaps, is why Camerano made his mistake in the libretto of the period.
It's with the newer period. Well, and I think at the second edition of it probably is the one that I would assume they would be referring to in Italy.
I would think
they would have gotten their hands on.
Yeah, because the other one would have sold out in England, right? So, but at any rate, they did screw up who died and who lived. The discussion is that King William of Orange, William the Third, right? William of Orange has died, and Mary will ascend the throne. Well, quite famously, William the Third slept on a pallet beside his wife's bed until she died. He wouldn't leave her room. He slept on the floor.
Wow.
And once she died, then he was able to leave the room, but he couldn't be alone anymore. He didn't want to be alone, even in his own rooms. He didn't want to be alone anymore for quite a while. And then he married her sister Anne.
Right.
But William didn't die and Mary didn't ascend the throne. That didn't happen. So that confusion caused us to have to go, there are too many Anglophiles and too many British citizens in our audience, and they will see that in the super titles and go, what? So we instantly started looking for, where could this be?
Uh-huh.
This is years ago, before 2006, when we were exploring the opera the first time. And in 1485, Henry Tudor killed Richard III and became the King of England, and nobody expected that. It was a complete shock.
That's right, yeah.
Nobody thought that was going to happen. So here suddenly we have a Welshman who is the King of England, who doesn't really have much of a claim to the throne of England, but he got it. And that threw Scotland, Wales, England, it was all thrown into turmoil.
Yeah.
Because, as we all know, the losing team got their heads cut off.
Yeah.
those who were instrumental.
So that is what Henry is trying to prevent and save his whole house from.
Trying to save his neck. And a few others as well. And, of course, all the land that they stole from the Ravenswoods. So,
gotta protect that stolen property.
So that's the whole point is that change of political issue,
right?
And to have it wrong in the text was I had trouble with that. But I'm so glad we changed it.
Oh, yeah, it's a
change of the texts, yes.
And we had to change two words only.
Yes,
right?
Enrico and
Guglielmo.
Yeah, just Guglielmo to
Gardo.
Yeah, exactly. Just two words.
Yeah, very
Maria,
simple.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we got to set it in 1485.
Which is fun.
Broadswords.
I know.
Daggers.
I love the set for this production is
and
just
the
awesome. The costumes are beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's. I think it's kind of more fun in this period. There's a little bit, I mean, to not have the kind of like, you know, collars and, you know,
rapiers
and things.
Oh, to do it in the period of William and Mary. Those are the ugliest clothes men ever wore in the history of the world. I mean, I'm sorry, Louis
although
XIV,
I don't get
for your
the,
bad taste. But
the curly mustache, that's, you know, we don't get the curly mustaches is the problem. That's I mean, I'll write a letter of discontent about that.
But you don't have to wear white stockings
thankfully.
With lace and ribbons all over your person.
Although I'm the priest, so I don't think, I think I would have avoided some
well,
of
Well, that's
the,
right. You'd have been in black anyway.
I would have
yes,
been wearing almost
right.
the same thing.
Yeah.
But the thing, in setting it here, the one thing I kind of wish I had was like a big fur mantle. Like I've told you this like four times. I wish I had like a big, you know, like bear skin, you know, fur over my shoulders for the whole thing. It's so ridiculous, but it'd be so Game of Thrones and like.
Well, I do think when I'm looking at it, I think, and you see, Game of Thrones came.
Oh yeah, no, it's like it's
only recently,
very conveniently.
So it's suddenly it's like, wow, we've sort of have a synchrony here with a big TV show. I have a godson who works in special effects in television, and he lost his Emmy to the Game of Thrones.
Oh.
that's
a tough one. That's, they're tough to beat these days.
Yeah, ain't nobody going to go up against those folks. But and one of our trustees sent me a little and says, we have to think of a new approach to attract young people to this opera. And I thought, honey, it's Game of Thrones.
That's great. We'll flay the Ravenswoods on the Boltons.
So no, it's right there. And yet it is the brilliant music of Donizetti. I think Donizetti is my favorite of the composers of that period.
He's brilliant. I mean, and really like all of the big ones, like Donizetti, Rossini, Bellini, it's a lot of mchuck, but what they do with the simplicity of these forms is just astounding
incredible.
To me.
Yeah,
I mean, we're just going like Cavatina Cabaletta. I mean, how many Cavatina Cabaletta things are in this show? I mean, everything is, pretty much. And
Every scene is built on that Rossini model.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Of fast, slow, fast.
And it's so exciting. The music, I mean, that's the thing, is the music is so exciting on its own.
Yes.
Like, I just, like, every time you and Kirk do that, the big love duet.
Yes.
I just get so, like, I get all the chills and excitement and that thing that you get when you hear great opera, when you're seeing it happen and you're in the house, that feeling of, like, oh, my God, they're going to do it again. They're going to sing it again. And you're excited about them doing the repeat. Like, it's a, like, you think, oh, do I really need to hear Verano
Ate Sulla? No, that's the most beautiful line.
It's my favorite music in the
whole
show. But every time it's like you think, like, oh, we're going to hear that for a
third
time.
Like,
third time
times,
now we're going to do it. And then when you bring it back in the mad scene, too, it's like,
oh, that's the genius of that.
It just kills.
For folks who don't understand what this mad scene is, it's really two arias linked by a cadenza.
Yes.
how to describe this cadenza?
And small scene in between. Yeah.
But the cadenza was actually introduced after Donizetti was a dead man. He didn't write this stuff.
Yeah. Oh.
It's all accretions by different sopranos over the years. And the big flute and voice cadenza, that's all added.
Oh,
I think Nellie Melba was responsible for some of it. Maria Callas is responsible for some of it. And it just grew and grew and grew.
Mm-hmm.
So that it is now the beating heart of the center of the opera is this huge mad scene.
Yeah,
and you cannot talk about mad scene without this cadenza.
Yeah.
No, it's non-existent. I mean, to do Lucia without the cadenza and the mad scene.
Yeah, that would
be. Well, I mean, everyone would just kind of look at each other like, I feel like we missed something.
Yeah.
Did I fall asleep?
Didn't know. Like, I feel like something was about to happen and it didn't happen.
So no, it's a part of the tradition now, and people do come specifically to hear it.
Well, it's such an exciting. Yes. And mad scenes are a whole thing unto opera, of course, with Ophelia and all of these.
Yes.
You know, there's so many good ones. I mean, gosh, even there's even a bass. There are two bass mad scenes.
Oh,
Yeah. Boris Godunov.
Oh, three then. I forgot about his. The clock scene. That's such a good one. But there's also Asur in Semiramide has a mad scene. And Attila in Verdi's Attila has a mad scene as
and
well.
And don't forget Orlando Furioso of Handel.
Oh, then it's four. Okay.
It's for mezzo. Yeah. So it wouldn't affect you.
It probably wouldn't get to do that one. But, you know, there's so many mad scenes, yeah. And they're, I don't know, there's something like weirdly satisfying about people losing their minds in opera. I don't know.
It's called no holds barred singing.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to make a periodic sense. You don't have to build a melody that has this and then it's going to bridge to that and then all of it has to come back again and then it has to do this. All the form just is out the window because the woman is mad. So whatever comes to her mind is what she's going to do. And it becomes a mask for the excuse to sing wildly difficult coloratura.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just display stuff, just fireworks for no purpose except that I can do it. Watch me do it. I can do it. Look, Mom, no hands. Right? There's no excuse for it. But she's mad, so you don't need any reason.
Well, and I think also tonally, you know, at the time, you know, when all this music was so tonal, to when someone goes crazy, I mean, like you have that sparasadiros.
Yeah.
And it's like the most Star Trek dissonance like thing going on, and it doesn't fit in the entire rest of the opera. It just and it comes out of
modern,
nowhere. It's it sounds like it's, you know, Strauss, we're in Elektra for about a minute. And that's, I mean, the fact that Donizetti got to do that and have that kind of grind into it is so cool. And I mean, that's like one of the advantages to being crazy is you get to do crazy stuff.
That's why every note
like that.
And every rhythm is so important in bel canto style of music.
Yeah, it's one of the hardest
things. It's all intended to.
Yeah,
and none of it is accidental. Mm-hmm. It's all intended to further the emotional state of that person.
Right. Every harmony, every breath, I mean, every...
Especially Donizetti. It's so carefully crafted. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I like to point out is the education that Donizetti got compared to Rossini, Bellini, and Verdi. Mm-hmm. Donizetti had the best education of all those people.
Oh, okay.
He was a peasant, a poor kid. He had nothing.
He married to this rich woman, though, right?
No, she was not rich.
Okay.
He married a woman because he completely fell in love with her.
Oh, okay.
She was his best friend's sister.
Oh.
And he met her in Rome and married her. And she was his life. And when she died, he almost died. People came and moved in with him. Because they were afraid that he was going to kill himself. So they set themselves up to have somebody with him all the time. Wouldn't leave him alone. And his letters at that time will just break your heart.
Okay.
Just break your heart. Well, but anyway, when he was born in Bergamo.
Right.
But to a family that was dirt poor, they were farm laborers. And his dad just insisted that they were going to get off of the flatlands down below and move to Saratoga. They were going to live up on the hill. And he didn't quite get inside the city, but he got inside the city wall, literally, inside the city wall, in a basement beneath a pawn shop. That's where they lived, with no light on the stairs to get from the pawn shop into their little rooms down there.
Wow.
But at the same time, Simone Meyer, was a German expatriate who lived in Italy and became among the most important composers living at the time.
Mm.
And he invented the Rossini crescendo.
Okay.
So he was a big deal composer, but he was also in charge of music at the great cathedral in Bergamo, the ancient medieval cathedral in Bergamo, which is still a walled city. And he went to them and said, okay, so Napoleon closed down all the church schools in all of northern Italy, but he's been dead for some time now. Don't you think we could open the choir school, please, so I could have decent musicians and singers, and it's time to train these young people? And Donizetti was in the first class.
Mm.
And he was 8 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. And, well, it was like their elementary school.
Yeah.
They learned how to read there.
I see.
Right? But basically, they learned how to read music there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear that the kid's voice was never going to blend. It was just too loud.
Yeah.
But Meyer so admired him that he decided, no, I'm not going to send you out of the school. He put him in charge of the music library, which meant he was copying out parts for all the instruments. And he then was or also taking care of the instruments themselves, and he learned how to play the instruments. And Meyer was teaching him one-on-one how to compose music, how to write music, how to copy music, all that kind of stuff, and finally, composition. So he'd been studying one-on-one with one of Italy's finest composers until he was 19.
Wow.
And then at 19, Meyer said, I have taught you everything I can teach you. So now you're going to go to Bologna and study with Rossini's teachers. So he went to Bologna and got his degree there and then went out into the world. And then Meyer is still helping him, getting him libretti and getting him gigs and commissions and help the kid do it. But and then he came up so slowly, striving and striving and striving and writing and writing and writing. Got a big break in Rome where he wrote something that got him a triumph, and they carried him through the streets with torches at night and all that kind of stuff. And then he writes, The Queen of England Who Lost Her Head, Anna Bolena.
Anna Bolena.
He wrote Anna Bolena, and boom, he was international. And then he writes The Elixir of Love. And then he just keeps, and then Lucia right after that. So
the,
all these things
and
start
then the
coming
rest
together.
Of the Tudor trilogy, which is so good too.
Yeah.
No, he got dramatic bel canto in a way, but then, but at the same time, Don Pasquale is so funny, and Elixir is so brilliant.
What is better than Don Pasquale? It's name me a comic opera that's better. You might find something that's
I love Nozze di Figaro.
So
I love Mozart comedy.
But it's a different comedy too, though. I mean, that's the interesting. It's like Rossini is so. I mean, like Barbara of Seville is that machine that just keeps on going. It will always be funny.
Yes.
I don't know how it's always funny, but it's always funny in some way.
So many and so much energy
and,
going on.
And Donizetti strikes this weird. It's so sincere. Like, the comedy of Don Pasquale is so ridiculous, but at the same time, like, the finale is by far, to me, like, the most sincere in this. Like, it's weird, right? That, you know, this whole, and the story, it's kind of silly. What, like, the old guy's like, I'm going to go get married, and he goes off, and, you know, they set him up with this girl, and you know from the start it's all going to end poorly, but he, like, the way he sees all these people is so different than the way, you know, with Rossini's more like kind of stock-ish people.
Commedia dell'arte characters.
And then, and of course the like Mozart da Ponte stuff is so intellectual and
but
just
it's,
quick and facile.
But it's also based in Commedia dell'arte.
Yes.
Still.
Oh, yes.
And Pasquale and Elixir and all that stuff.
That's people.
I see.
Yeah. It's well, think about Nemorino.
Yeah.
I mean, Nemorino is like a character in an opera.
Everywhere.
Yeah. It's like he's that. I mean, we all know Nemorino is like the, you know, overly lovesick kind of sort of lame guy.
Needy.
You know? He's, yeah, needy always. I know at least.
He's
a
so
couple.
Needy. Sometimes, like. He just
but he's
annoys
sweet.
Me.
Yeah, he's like kind of annoying, but he's so
he annoys
sweet.
Her too.
Yeah, it's great.
Exactly.
And also, I mean, his understanding of like these women, like Norina and God, I'm terrible with names today. In Elixir, her name is
Adina.
Yeah,
those are smart girls.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are really, really with it, ladies.
And Adina is so much more human than Rossina.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rossina is a cardboard cutout, whereas Adina, she's flesh and blood.
Yeah. And she has so many layers of emotions.
Yeah. Speaking of layers, that's the thing that Lucia astonishes me. It finally has one aria that is unalloyed, and that's the tenor's final aria.
Well, that's one of the. What is, was it? Oh gosh, was it Lily Pons? No, it wasn't Lily Pons. Someone I remember, some famous soprano said that they would never sing Lucia because of that the tenor aria. Because you go out and you sing the mad scene and you do all that,
and then
like the greatest tenor aria ever written or whatever. You know, I mean, really, it's like one of the greatest scenes in opera period.
Yeah.
And I mean, the way it just it goes and goes. I mean, and it's brutal. It's like the hardest thing to sing in the world.
I don't know
how Kirk does.
It's a brutal sing.
As well.
He sounds
fresh as can be the whole
time. Kirk Doherty is a miracle.
Incredible. Yeah.
I mean, the music director texts me in the middle of the last scene and says, this guy has such stamina.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's just, he just keeps going.
And that aria is a killer. But the music is just, oh, it just kills you. Mm-hmm. It just kills you. And then the way, even when he comes back and the orchestra is playing his theme, mm-hmm. and he does the, ah, te vengo, that, and it just, it's breaking down, and the drama with the, you know, with the music and everything all becomes so perfectly intertwined. And of course, this is after you've sung how much?
Well, the first question I always have, if we're going to, when I knew we were about to do Lucia again, because I'd said we need to do Lucia because I heard Sylvia Lee. So we need to do Lucia. Actually, we'd planned it before you.
Yeah. But you heard her and we're like, that's it. That's our girl.
When I heard Sylvia Lee, I didn't know I needed a Lucia. I thought I had one on staff. I thought I had one in the resident company.
Oh.
I was not looking for a soprano to sing this. I was looking for covers.
Yeah.
That's what I was looking for. But I wrote on Sylvia's resume at the top, were I looking for a Lucia, this would be my first choice.
Oh, wow.
That's right.
And then I could show it to you on your resume.
Okay.
And then the next morning I discovered I was looking for a Lucia.
And then you picked up the phone.
So actually, Corey Dostour, you know, our director of artistic planning, she got on the phone to your agent. And here you are. So happy. Aww. How happy is that?
We're all happy about that.
Yeah. How happy is that? But I'm going back to the complexity of this work. From the first minute, nobody has an easy choice to make.
No.
Not until Edgardo is going to kill himself does mm-hmm. anybody have an easy choice to make.
Nope.
It's all impure. And there's so many things based on deception. And here we have Henry finds out that Edgar is back in town. He wants to kill him. Well, that's true enough. But then suddenly we find out that Edgar and Lucy have fallen in love.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that makes for a mess. I mean, that wonderful love duet is filled with, oh, and by the way, I have sworn to kill your entire family, and I could still go do that, because all they want is me dead, right?
I mean, really, he's kind of like...
Lucia is trying to stop him. Like, that's all about
it. It's not the thing to bring up with your girlfriend, right?
No.
You know I'm supposed to kill your whole family, right?
Blood and like...
Like, you must know I really
revenge.
Like you, because I'm not killing your family right now.
Well, that's his proposal. I'm going to go to your brother, and I'm going to make friends with him and ask for your hand in marriage. He says, oh, no, you can't do that. He will kill you. your family. So there's never a time. And on the way into the wedding scene, when Henry is forcing his sister to do this thing that is really mm-hmm. wrong, and he knows it's really wrong, he knows that she's married. He knows that she's damning herself to hell for eternity if she marries this other man.
Of course.
And yet he forces her into it. And he feels such remorse over that. Mm-hmm. But he's going to save his life and the whole family. He's going to do it, whatever the sacrifice is.
Yeah.
He's going to save the family. So he pushes that forward. So he is all conflicted and yet having to move forward against his will to do this thing that's going to happen.
And at the same time dealing with this immense hatred for Edgardo that he's got the entire time.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the hardest things for, I think, you know, we're doing this in this aria that's frequently cut for Raimondo, where I essentially am sitting down with Lucia and telling you this is to save your family. I actually say, offer yourself as a sacrifice mm-hmm. to save your family, and your tears will be dried in heaven.
Yes,
that's awfully dramatic. First of all, what a thing to say to someone, but.
But she's in the position where she has to make her mind up.
And we all know, everyone in the whole house at this point knows what needs to happen to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that they'll live and, you know, make it through the scourge or whatever. And I don't think Raimondo's happy about having to to tear her away from this, because I mean, I like to think that he's
a sincere, you've been trying
nice
to
guy.
Aid and abet her relationship.
Absolutely,
you've been trying to get information to him to warn mm-hmm. him that this wedding is about to take place.
Well, and in typical tenor fashion, he's like off doing whatever tenors do, and you know, he's not writing back. He needs to text back.
But he lost his phone. He
ran out of battery in France, and he's just
he can't text back. He never got any of the letters, but evidently he did get the one through your special message.
Right, so which is what brings him back.
Instead mm-hmm. of answering it, he hopped on his pony
mm-hmm. and rode.
And has not put his foot on the earth except to change horses all the way until he's there. Of course, in operatic fashion, he arrives
right in the
3 minutes too late. Yes. 3 minutes too late.
Right after I signed the contract. Yeah. He could enter like a minute before.
Yeah.
Yes. It should be like right after.
You know, he had to go and stop and use the bathroom because he was riding for so long. Yeah. So if he just powered through, he probably would have made it.
Uh-huh. So I think this is one of the most fascinating operas of all time.
Yes.
It's brilliant.
I love it.
It seems, I think a lot of people feel like it's just a stand and sing, like, oh, it's just Lucia. Blah. But these are really interesting people with really interesting motivations and in horrible situations mm-hmm. that, I mean, what would we do? I mean, if you try to put yourself in the shoes of these people, like, what would you do? Like, would you marry the guy you don't want to marry? Would you, you know, turn your back on God? Would you turn your back on your family? Would, you know, they're not, like you've said, these are no easy choices for any of them.
It's the Romeo and Juliet problem.
Yeah.
And so many stories of great import are based on secret marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's moving along making plans, not knowing that this very vital element in their plan is no longer viable. And in the days of arranged marriage, who in the Middle Ages or right through to the 18th, not until the 19th century
right.
are people marrying for any reason except it furthers
convenience.
The family's plan for getting closer to the king, closer to money, more land.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only things that marriage was about.
Yeah.
Your daughter married the miller if you were poor,
mm-hmm.
because guess what? The miller has a mill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a step up, right? And everybody's after a step up, and women were used for that, as were men.
Mm-hmm.
Men were assigned to marry duchesses or mm-hmm. princesses or whatever the hell,
yes.
And women, the same thing. Marriage was an assignment. And how lucky people felt. And this was in the 18th century. There was much talk about a lucky marriage because they actually liked each other. Not that they were in love with each other.
No, but that they
could
they
liked
stand each
other.
And
they had common interests and common values, and mm-hmm. they liked each other. And even in the 19th century, in the high families, marriages were arranged, especially English families. Yeah. All these,
even in like early 20th centuries, right?
I think, in England, I know it still continued. Maybe not as dramatic, you know, as like officially, but I think people still were trying to preserve family mm-hmm. importance and worth
classes,
and all of that.
Yeah, maintain your class. And the loss of money in England that happened all through the 19th century and especially after World War mm-hmm. I, they were trying to marry American heiresses, right? So this thing of...
I saw some documentaries about it, yes.
Yeah, it was very common. Some of the greatest fortunes in England were brought from America with the wife.
Mm-hmm.
The Churchills.
Downton Abbey is about this kind of story.
There are a couple of characters.
Yes. And in real life today, guess what? Highclere Castle, which is Downton Abbey, the guy married a Texas millionaire.
Oh.
So she arrived from Texas, and now she's a duchess.
Uh-huh.
And they called me, she says, and they call me Your Grace. she thinks it's just cute. But she made it possible for this guy to maintain the land and house, because you run out of money. In the olden days when they were building these things, they had all these colonies all over the world.
Yes.
All this money was flowing in that they were hoovering up all over Africa mm-hmm. and Asia and wherever the hell, India, hoovering up all the money everywhere. And they lived like kings. But that went away, and Many of those houses are collapsed.
Oh, completely.
Which brings us to the ruins of Lucida Lammermoor.
To our beautiful set.
We have spectacular ruins on our set.
The ruins. I remember the first day we saw the ruins. I was like, ooh, those look amazing.
Yes.
My favorite scene still is when the main goes up for the first time.
It looks great with the...
The lighting.
The moss and everything and the trees.
It's just magical. Mm-hmm. It thrills me every time I see it. I'm sorry that we can't have the Wolf's Crag scene. we built a Wolf's Crag scene, but we can't have the Wolf's Crag scene because it takes too long to change the damn set. Yeah. So the new stage director didn't like the idea, so we just stay in the house. But, you know, that's the French version.
Right, talked a lot. Yes. Ben's talked a lot about French version and how when he revised it, that he took away the character of Elisa and, added a tenor. He basically fused Elisa and Normanno together into a character named Gilbert, who is kind of this, sort of evil confidant kind of guy who's driving all this stuff along in a not-so-good way. And, I really need to listen to it now because I've never heard the French version. And I heard that, I guess, Renyava is not in it.
It's not
That's
in
cut.
It. When I first, I was searching for this recordings of Lucia when I, started to study the first time. And I found this French version and I was listening to it. And, I was like, what did I bought? Is this the same Lucia? I mean, this is Donizetti and it's Lucia di Lammermoor, but my score is totally different thing.
Then what's going on?
Yes, I was like, what is this?
I think it's very different.
All those rewrites, you know? Because if you didn't make it in Paris, you hadn't made it anywhere, right?
No.
You had to make it in Paris.
Well, and of course, so many of Donizetti's operas are like that. Well, what is it? And Rossini, too. I mean,
and Verdi.
Yeah, and Verdi.
And Bellini.
Mm-hmm. Sicilian Vespers.
They premiered in Italy.
Ballet.
Yeah.
All things had to change.
Yeah, that's right. You always have to write the ballet in for the French.
Oh, and
that's
poor Verdi. He just hated that.
He did. He hated the
And he punishes us because when the ballet music comes on, he's punishing us.
Yeah.
The funny thing that I find are men's choruses in Verdi and in Donizetti, and I don't know about Bellini because I'm not really a fan, but Verdi and Donizetti's men's choruses, it's always I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. You know, they're just also kind of corny. And why? Did they think men were really stupid? Is that what?
The men's chorus in Bel Canto, they have a special purpose, don't they? We always have it so, in apprentice gigs when we have to do chorus, it's always the worst because the girls are always like, oh, well, we're off now. Yeah, we sang our 2 minutes, and the guys are there for the whole night in every scene, standing there holding their, polearms and whatever, guarding the doors. And they're always busy, but they're. It's always that kind of, even the tu dubbio mai certezza, but it's kind of silly music. Oh,
Verdi, you just go, what?
But they're, I don't know. I in Verdi, in Rigoletto, the men's chorus in that has
That's my favorite.
But that's very sophisticated music.
Yes.
That's later on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the Verdi, earlier Verdi
gets very sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. It's and early Verdi, of course, is. I mean, Have you done any early Verdi?
No.
Lady Macbeth. Didn't you sing Lady Macbeth?
No. Because I did Un Giorno di Regno.
I saw that in your resume.
Is really not a great opera. I mean, it was, and the story behind that opera, I mean, is sort of funny because it's not funny. It's quite sad. His family died while he was writing this comedy, and it was his second opera. He had had the success with Oberto, which was kind of more of a drama, and then they asked him to write a comedy, and so he writes Un Giorno di Regno, and it really sounds like, Don Pasquale or Barbers. It's very much in that vein of music, and the story is very silly and whatever. But his family died while he was writing it, and he said, "I want to stop. I'm so destroyed." And we know that the death of his family marked Verdi for the rest of his life and everything.
Three children, one after the, no, two children and his wife.
Yeah, just all boom,
one
boom,
year,
boom.
The next year, and then the wife. Donizetti, three children, and then his wife.
Yeah,
Ugh. All in short order. And
I guess that's how you get good operas. I mean, mm-hmm. but they, it's, yeah, so many composers lost families or had these horrible events that ended up marking the way they wrote and how they wrote. And I mean, Giorno is crap because they died and he just couldn't write anything funny. It just, he couldn't make it work. Mm. And so it's kind of a, I mean, it has its moments, but in general, it's pretty, well.
You do chat on.
Yeah, sure. And, but all of that early Verdi stuff is, it's a lot like Lucia, right?
Yes.
You know, I mean, do you feel like singing Gilda is a lot
Gilda
like singing
is more,
Lucia?
More like bel canto. I mean, Rigoletto
yeah.
is more. Like
yeah, it's very bel canto, think, and yeah. It's later. It's a little bit later on, but I mean, like, yeah, does it feel like you sing yeah. similarly?
I think it's still considered early Verdi yeah. because singing Gilda is really similar to
Lucia.
Lucia.
Or?
I mean, I don't sing much Verdi except
no, probably
Gilda,
Oscar,
and
maybe.
Oscar, and then the last one, the Falstaff,
Nannetta. Yeah, Nannetta.
Those three I can sing, but Traviata maybe later.
No, it's...
but it's different.
It's it is different, his style. Whereas for me, it's like this... I mean, like I keep saying, one of the fun things for me about doing this opera is like this is beginning Verdi, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, like, 'cause the first aria for me is so normal bel canto, and uh-huh. then the second aria is just... It's like I'm, you know, we're getting into Trovatore, we're getting into
yes,
that musical language
yes.
and that kind of vocal emphasis, mm-hmm. which is so different than.
Actually, I think Gilda is also written for the soprano who sings also Leonora in Trovatore.
Of course.
Yes, but they added some high notes mm-hmm. and some embellishments.
Right.
Yes.
No, Gilda doesn't written. It's not
no, it's
actually
not written,
very high.
No,
it's
not
just
written
the,
as that high. I mean, they added later. I mean,
yeah.
I think he added later. Or
well, I think Verdi
else.
Approved of a lot of that.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
maybe there's a lot of excess mm-hmm. high note in, frankly, all of these operas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've heard, I mean, I'm sure you've heard Silly.
I mean, it's excited to hear high notes
yeah,
some,
well,
at some points, right?
I played for Silvia a recording of the Cavaletta to Reniava that has a lot of high notes, and it's pretty terrible.
Yeah, but let's not mention about
that. No, but it's, there's so much embellishment in these pieces.
Yes.
When I was a little boy, my dad found out about stereo recordings.
Oh,
and
okay.
It was a new invention, right?
Yeah.
And you could go down to Sears and buy a Silvertone reel-to-reel tape recorder.
Oh.
And you could buy the train that goes by or the closet
wow.
that everything falls out of
so
the closet
be like
and
sound.
Falls across the floor. Yes,
oh
yes,
my
yes.
gosh.
I but, see. I can understand. Yeah.
yeah. So he thought that was just spectacular.
Oh, yeah.
Of course,
hear the
yes.
train going by. Wow. But he also had my stepmother with him, and she picked up some recordings of music because thinking
yeah.
that might be good. And a buddy of hers gave her a recording of Joan Sutherland's The Art of the Prima Donna.
Oh.
Okay, I was
yep.
9, maybe 10.
That'll do it.
Yep.
And I had never heard any serious music.
Yeah.
Ever, not a note of it.
Mm.
I'd heard what we did in church, mm-hmm. and my grandma and grandpa always watched Lawrence Welk, right? So I had never heard a note of serious music, never once any serious music, and put this thing on, not knowing what it is, and was stunned. I was just stunned.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to it so much that I could sing along with her
wow.
the whole Art of the Prima Donna.
Oh my gosh.
I could sing it all. I'm a little 10-year-old kid.
That's incredible.
In the way out in the countryside. Oh.
And you're just singing with Joan.
Florida.
Singing with Joan.
I'd be in my little bicycle, right? with no shirt, no shoes.
Singing the bell song.
Just pedaling down the road. And I'm singing all these cabalettas. Of course, phony Italian, but if she could
kind.
Sing it, I could sing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You
wow.
know, when you're 10. But that to me, for some reason, has dwelt in my heart as this is what opera really is.
Uh-huh.
It's singing of this magnitude.
Yeah.
It's emotion that is this strong.
Mm-hmm.
And the other stuff, I get it. It's opera. I'm fine with it. But what speaks to my heart, truly,
yeah.
are those big, magnificent arias.
Well, I think
yeah.
there's really opera good. And there's opera, you know.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
there's Fledermaus, and then there's Boris Godunov or, you know, Trovatore or Gioconda. Like, there's opera and there's opera. And yeah. Lucia is one of those, like, it's got all of those big moments, which is what a lot of opera fans really want. I mean, it's nice to go hear Sullaria, mm-hmm. you know, and all that stuff. But when you have some, like, someone good just like screaming through Trovatore, or like, you know, you get to the, you know, it's Don Carlo and you have the friendship duet at the beginning and the two guys just rip. It's like sports for me. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's the same kind of feeling. Like there's this excitement about the whole thing that just hits this like weirdly primal, like blood pumping kind of thing that you wouldn't think you, like, it seems weird that you'd feel that way in an opera house, but
that's what opera is about. That's the reason you go to opera. That's the reason you go to symphony. You know, it's the reason. That's the reason that we do
that,
this.
That it
and
just
nothing
gets you going.
Else does it.
Not like that.
No.
When I go, I was a teenager when I heard first time the Beethoven Seventh Symphony.
That's.
And then in college, I had to, in formative analysis, I had to study the slow movement of the Seventh Symphony. So I'd never sat down with a score before, right? So I sit down, open the score, put the headphones on, I'm playing it. Dee, 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 right? And then I go, oh, well, look, it's just the same music with this other thing underneath it. Oh, well, look, it's just the same music with yet another thing underneath it. Oh, my God, it's not possible to have it have this much meaning and it just be the same music with just another thing in it. It's just, it was like, this is not possible. And it was like my chest is pounding and my face is red, and I've when you understand how it's constructed,
it's so tightly
constructed, and yet it has such power. This is the reason I do this. Mm-hmm. This is the reason, and it is very often I find myself in the theater and the orchestra has arrived, we've had a couple of tech rehearsals. And I find myself going down to the orchestra pit and kneeling beside the conductor to say, we have the best job on earth.
I think we do.
Who could have a better job than this?
That's right.
It's the best job on earth.
There's so much craziness and so much, there's so many challenges. And yet those moments when it happens, when we see it, when we're, you know, you're there, you're in the house, you're on the stage and the orchestra is playing underneath you and the audience like is looking at you and just waiting for it. There's nothing better than being part of that energy, wherever you are, mm-hmm. in the food chain of, or, you know, the ecosystem of opera, like that moment, that's the best thing. It makes us all feel alive. I mean, I think that's the one thing everyone who works in this business could agree is like the reason we're here. It's not to sit around and look at the score and to, you know, rehearsing is great and we need it and I love rehearsing, but like the moments when we are changing, when we're creating this like little bubble that people can mm-hmm. be in, where they can feel all of these things, and we can feel all of these things, and we can share our souls, and we can, and our feelings, and tell a story that means something. It's the best. And it's this isolated moment in time that never happens again, which is like, I mean, right? Like, I mean, what Joni Mitchell said, this hilarious thing where, you know, being, because she also painted, and in addition to singing and playing guitar, and she would say, you know, like, you know, no one went to Picasso and was like, hey, man, I mean, to, you know, Van Gogh and said, hey, paint Starry Night again. You know, like, no one does that. No one says that. But here we are, like, it's 2016. It's almost 2017. And we're painting Lucia di Lammermoor again.
Yes.
Because it only exists while we're painting.
Exactly.
Minute we lay down our brush, it ceases.
And it's a new thing every time. Like, and every night of the run will be a whole new thing.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting. We used to have two resident companies in San Jose. Two resident casts. So every role was double cast. And people, many, many, many subscribers had two subscriptions because they wanted to see the other cast.
Oh.
And they were very distraught when I decided we could not afford to have two resident casts. That was too luxurious for what we were doing. We were going to have to take it down to one. And they were going, oh, and some of them kept their two subscriptions. And they're coming to say, but it's still different when I come back to the second performance.
Absolutely.
It's still different.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah,
it's not a movie.
People, not machines. I mean, we are different every day.
And I mean, I can guarantee I'll forget something.
No.
Just don't. Never mind. I don't want to tempt fate.
Yeah.
But I do realize we've been at this for an hour and 4 minutes.
Whoa.
So we're having good of a time.
That's the thing.
And we don't even have any beer. How do we do that?
Because we're talking opera.
Yes.
It's bad. I can go on and on and on.
So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you. It's
happy
been
to be here.
Just grand to get to know you. Because, I mean, you know, I'm always in my stupid ivory tower and I have such little time to be among the performers. And when I am, you're up there rehearsing and I'm just in the back watching and I send you a text that says thank you, you know. that's hardly,
I mean, that means a lot to me. I mean,
it does
to
I mean one of the best things about this company in particular that I've experienced in my brief, you know, month that I've been here, really, or month and a half or whatever it's been now, is that you guys are always there and supportive and, you know, to be constantly like getting notes and calls to check up on us and make sure we have what we need and that the rehearsals are going well and that we're, you know, do we feel good about how this is? And to say, oh my God, you sounded incredible in that rehearsal is just the best.
Yes.
Because, you know, to have that
helps us a lot.
Makes doing this job so much easier.
That lady who's up there singing Isolde, that's my boss since 1979 until she died 2 years ago. And she founded this company as a singer for singers. The whole point is to help you be comfortable enough to do your best work. And that's been the goal from the beginning, to help you be comfortable enough to do your best work so that you can go out in front of a public and show them what your best work is. And then that prepares you for your next step. Now, her life, she was a student. She went to Columbia University and studied music education, right? She went to San Jose State first, went to Columbia. She was way ahead. She she graduated from high school early, graduated from undergrad early, and then graduated, did her master's degree in 1 year at Columbia.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. She's like that.
There's
and then she wins a Fulbright and goes to Milan to study for a year, found a teacher. Took her a long time to find a teacher. So she finds a teacher. So her family says, well, we'll just pay for you to stay in Milano. So all her brothers and sisters got together and sent money so she could stay in Milan for another year. So she was 2 years in Milan. Rudolf Bing heard her in the second year. She was playing the auditions for the Metropolitan Opera. She was playing the piano.
Oh, my gosh.
For the auditions.
I had no idea.
Yeah, Irene was playing the piano for the auditions. And then she stood up and sang something. And Rudolf Bing called her over and says, do you sing the judgment scene from Aida? And she said, well, no, I've not sung that before. And he says, well, you can read anything. You've been sight reading all day long, so could you come back this afternoon? They're going to break for lunch. Could you come back this afternoon and sing it for me? And she said, absolutely.
And just learn the judgment scene of Maida over lunch and come back and sing it for us.
So she goes to her voice teacher's house and says, oh my God, he wants me to sing the judgment scene. What am I going to do? He says, well, we'll just go through it, okay? We'll just go through it. You'll sing it with the score. So we'll just go through it to make you, and you can sing it, Irene. She wasn't Irene then. She was Yvonne.
That's right. That's right.
She was Yvonne Patricia Dallas. And so she sings it for him. That evening, Rudolf Bing comes to her voice teacher's house for dinner because the voice teacher's cousin, who lived in the same house, was his representative. He scouted out the talent for Mr. Bing to hear in two different European countries, and Italy was one. So, of course, the question is, did you hear anybody that you would care to, you know, hear again or anything? And Bing said, no, well, actually, yes, there's this one. And he pulls out his little black book, which he had three, never hear this singer again, hear this singer in 3 years, and hire this singer. So he pulled out his Hire the Singer book. He said that this Yvonne Dallas, at which point her voice teacher, quote, spat out my soup. Completely shocked him. And then he says to Bing, but you can't have her. And evidently Bing says back, I'm Rudolph Bing.
I'll have what I want.
He says, but she has never been on stage in her life. Mm. Oh, then I'll wait 4 years. So Irene immediately got a job in a place called Oldenburg in mm-hmm. northern Germany. She sang there for 2 years, where she learned Lady Macbeth, Ortrud, Daphne. I mean, all these roles mm-hmm. she assembled, and over a two-year period, she learned all these roles. And then she went to Berlin. She was at Berlin 1 year and went on as Janufa, pardon me, as Kostelnicka in Janufa.
Such a great role, my God.
And she was still a kid.
That's insane to do it at that age, too.
Honey,
that's something that people wow. weigh.
She was 29.
Wow.
Jeez.
And huge reviews. The next morning came the cable from the Met. And she negotiated a contract. So she was wow. then 2 years total in Berlin and then walked on stage at the Metropolitan Opera as Eboli.
Wow.
That's
amazing story.
And stayed for 20 years.
Wow.
And then came to San Jose and to San Jose State University, and I went to San Jose State because I found out this woman was there. So, and how strange, she made me her graduate assistant in 1979, and I worked for her ever after.
And now here we all are today.
Yeah.
Because Irene Dallas couldn't figure out how these young singers who were finishing with their graduate study, mm-hmm. who she thought were ready to go on stage, as ready as she was at Oldenburg.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have an Oldenburg.
And that's the thing in the States that I think is particularly challenging is there aren't places for young singers. There aren't many places for young singers to cut their teeth in roles on stage. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of places where you can go and you can sing the Herald or the Second Armed Man
yes.
or Montano
speaker.
You know, there's plenty of companies that will have
flower
you in to
girls.
Do that stuff. Yeah, the Flower Girls in Figaro. Oh, my God. Yeah, but how do you learn to be a great artist doing that stuff?
Mm.
I mean,
and that was Irene's point. You must go out in leading roles.
You have to. Yeah. There's no other way to learn it.
And from the first day, mm-hmm. our artists all went out in leading roles. They may only sing two leading roles and the other two operas a year supporting roles
mm-hmm.
In the early days before Opera San Jose proper was formed.
Right.
You did what and sometimes you'd be
what
singing
was necessary.
In the chorus. You'd be singing in the
and
chorus.
That's just...
Yeah. You'd be Rodolfo in one show and a tenor in the chorus in the next show. But over time, this thing happened. It just happened.
Yeah.
And it was not a plan. It was never a plan. It was just the next logical
Probably
step.
Probably why it happened.
Yeah, the next logical
when it just
step.
Happens, that's always when magic occurs. No, and I mean, like, just for me to, like, be able to come here and do, you know, Raimondo, Lucia gets done all the time. This is yes. theoretically one of the roles that I should be able to do for the rest of my life. Basilio mm-hmm. in Barber of Seville, another one like that where I assume I've done it once before when I was very young, and I assume I'll do it many, many more times in my life.
Yes.
And then we get to do Silent Night, which is a spectacular new opera that I'm so excited about, and I get to have a really fun role in that and try something totally new. And then to come back and do Colline again, which is a role that I've done a few times now, but is that there's always something new to find in. And I mean, to be working these things so that when I go out, it's like, oh yeah, no, this regular part of my repertoire I've got. Like, I'm ready to go with this. And like, I'm not scared.
And once you've sung six performances of it, it will be there.
It's there.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yep.
It will be there.
You're just ready to jump in.
Sylvia only has two giant roles.
Yes.
Yeah, I have four kind of like medium-sized guys, and you're just like, I'll take the whole show, please. Thank you.
But you do have to learn Rosina.
Yes.
Which will be good for you.
I actually performed it once. Yeah.
See, and it's useful. Mezzos tend to be singing it
mm. right now. It's much more popular mm-hmm. for
but
them
it. That was not the norm when I was a kid. Roberta Peters was the most important
oh,
yes.
was a great
Rosina
one.
When I was a kid, yes. and Beverly Sills was certainly mm-hmm. a big Rosina.
Mm-hmm.
Maria Callas was a yeah. big Rosina. So it's just silly to think that only mezzos should be doing this role. That's just goofiness. Mm-hmm. So I don't support that, frankly. So I'm at least glad you're going to be covering it. Yes. And you are performing it, right? No?
No.
Well, at least you will have the student matinee.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely that. So, but, and then Mimi.
Yes.
And that's terribly exciting.
I know. I can't wait.
Yeah. Very different than Lucia.
I know, yeah.
But it'll be.
Yeah, the exact opposite end. They both die, but but Mimi dies on stage.
Yeah. Oh,
peacefully,
God.
Peacefully.
Yes. And happily.
Among her friends and lovers. Yes.
It's one of the most challenging death scenes for those reasons. Mm-hmm. Because it's so, I mean, how many times have I seen a soprano decide, I'm going to tragically die as Mimi now? And I look at them and I'm like, what are you doing? You better be smiling. You better be smiling all through Act 4. Because she could not be happier. And she says it over and over again, how happy she is and how perfect these moments are. Mm-hmm. And when she dies, she really could not be happier. She is in the only place in the world that she wants to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so hard. It's like what's so tragic in that one is that
she's in happiness.
Yeah, she's so pristine and perfect and happy, and the tragedy is all around her. The tragedy is for who's left behind.
And isn't that the real truth about death?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, even in Lucia here, what the tragedy for Edgardo is less that Lucia died, I think, and more that he missed. Like, he was late. That if he had been back in time, maybe something could have been different.
And if he hadn't been such as a horse's butt.
He'd just been nice to her brother in the first place.
So, but...
there's a lot... Well, this is an opera of... If this one thing had happened differently, if Raimondo had said, wait, you know, maybe we can put this off a little bit longer. Let's see if we... Let me see what I can do. Or if Enrico had said, you know, let me talk to him. Let's try to reconcile this problem. There's so many times you think if this had happened slightly differently.
But what's at stake still is the life
exactly
of the Cian of the family. Mm-hmm. There's no way around that.
No.
His life is in jeopardy. And if he doesn't turn it around, he's going to die. And guess what? He's going to die.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because he couldn't turn it around.
And Arturo is dead.
That's
right. Well, the question that I've been asking myself all the time is like, What does Arturo's family do after this? That's actually a very interesting second act because, of course, his family is so powerful and I mean, the reason they're allying themselves is to have those resources. And then is he like, do they come storming into the castle and kill everyone?
Something like that.
I mean, that would be a great next opera, right?
Henry is dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need an opera called Henry Ashton.
Let's do it.
Okay, well, we should say goodbye. This has been too much fun.
Too much fun. Always.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a joy. Bye-bye.